So we are now ready. We have all the machinery of quantum field theory. We can apply it to cosmology now. So today we start with that. And we will apply quantum field theory to Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetimes. This is based on the observation that on scales larger than about a billion light years, the universe is spatially very flat. As far as we can measure, it is flat. So if you were to draw a triangle in the universe of side lengths of the order of a billion light years, the angles would add up to 180 degrees pretty accurately. Also, the observation is that the cosmic expansion is very isotropic. As far as we can measure, the universe is expanding in every direction equally. Based on that, it is a good approximation for large-scale physics, that is to say for cosmology, to assume that the universe is described by Friedmann-Robertson-Walker-Lemaître metric. So we model spacetime as having no spatial curvature at all. There's only curvature between space and time, and curvature between space and time is expansion. Basically, because if you remember what curvature means, it means that if you go in along a parallelogram, you get some non-triviality. And if one step is in space and one step is in time, then what expansion means is that it makes a difference whether you first do a step in space and then wait, or you first wait and then make a step in space. So expansion is an expression of curvature between space and time. That we have, but we are assuming here in a very good approximation for large scales that there is no spatial curvature between space and space directions at all. Now, a small remark. It turns out that because the Einstein equations are nonlinear, there are solutions that are surprising. There are solutions and known solutions to the Einstein equation which temporarily mimic this, where the universe is temporarily pretty much isotropically expanding and isotropic and pretty much flat, but it kind of has a momentum and diverges from that quickly. So it really takes the observation over billions of light years in space and billions of years in time to confirm that we're dealing with an FRW space-time. Now, once we make the assumptions of isotropy and homogeneity and non-triviality only in expansion, we can choose convenient coordinates. So first of all, what do we choose for the time coordinate? Well, in order to define the time coordinate, I have to introduce the notion of peculiar velocity. So consider the universe as it is expanding. Then the motion that galaxies have because of the expansion of the universe is called the Hubble flow. So galaxies generally drift away from each other because space is expanding. That motion is the Hubble flow. But on top of that, you can have that, for example, galaxies attract each other. They might crash into each other, they might orbit each other. All of that is peculiar velocity. This is the definition of peculiar velocity, whereas the Hubble flow is what the galaxies would do if they had no extra velocities, no peculiar velocities. So the peculiar velocity is the small extra random velocity that galaxies can possess relative to the general Hubble flow. Now we define the time coordinate of FRW spacetimes, time coordinate t, to be the proper time of a freely streaming, freely falling observer who has no peculiar velocity. It's basically the time shown by a watch, worn by somebody who is in a galaxy that doesn't have a peculiar velocity. A galaxy that's just moving along with the Hubble flow, but doesn't move against the Hubble flow in any way. Pretty much it's our wristwatch time. Our galaxy does have some peculiar velocity, but it's not extreme. Now it's very important that we define what we mean by this time variable here, because if we chose the time of another observer, then we might get, for example, a completely different answer for what the age of the universe is. Consider, for example, a proton or an electron that has been emitted by some high energy process very early in the universe that might still be traveling now. Now, if it's been traveling at the speed, almost the speed of light, maybe for this particle, the universe is only a million years old. And that's true, right, for that particle. So the time coordinate of FOW space-time is the time as measured by an inertial observer traveling with the Hubble flow. And when we say that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, this is the clock we are referring to. How about spatial coordinates? It turns out that in an expanding universe, in our universe, for the purpose of cosmology, it is useful to adopt a coordinate system that's called a co-moving coordinate system. And that takes a little bit of getting used to. And the way we do that is that we choose a time T naught. Typically, this would be our time now. And then we set up, at least in a Gedanken experiment, we set up an ordinary rectangular coordinate system, ordinary Cartesian coordinate system, where this is a meter, and so on. So we set up an ordinary rectangular coordinate system at a particular time, usually today. But then, this coordinate system is not held fixed, but instead, we let the coordinate system grow with the Hubble flow. What does that mean? It means in practice this. Let's say we measure the distance to the nearest galaxy, and it's so many light years, right? There's a few light years. Now, let's say it's X number of light years. Then let's wait for a long time. The Hubble flow goes on. Then what's the distance now to that galaxy? Numerically, it would be the same. Now, I actually picked an example. It's not that great because our nearest galaxy is Andromeda and it has a peculiar velocity. It's heading towards us and we are heading towards it. So let's just say we take our galaxy and a galaxy far away and we measure what the distance is between the two. And then we wait a billion years or 2 billion years. What is the distance now? Numerically, still the same. Right? It's numerically the same because we let the coordinate system grow with the Hubble flow. So the advantage of using a co-moving coordinate system is this. The distance between galaxies stays the same. If you drew a map of the universe, it would be the same. It would not expand, right? All the distances would be numerically the same, except for the peculiar velocities between the galaxies. It would also mean this. Imagine you have a light wave. Let's say you send a laser beam to some other galaxy. So you have this light wave and it has a certain wavelength. Now, how does that wavelength behave under the Hubble flow? Well, under the Hubble flow, the wavelength will be stretched. But in this coordinate system, in the co-moving coordinate system, the wavelength stays exactly the same. Because just as the wave packet is being stretched apart, the coordinate system is stretched at exactly the same rate. These are both go with the Hubble flow. So therefore, wavelengths stay the same. This is important later on. It's crucial. It's ultimately the reason why we do it. It's because when the wavelength stays numerically the same, it means that the corresponding momentum, k, stays numerically the same. That would be the co-moving momentum. That would be super convenient. Convenient in the sense that if we go back to the beginning of the course, we looked at the Klein-Gordon equation, and we saw that in position space, the harmonic oscillators of the field are coupled to each other because of the Laplacian term. So before it transformed, and then the harmonic oscillators were decoupled. In an expanding space time, that doesn't work. You will see that the harmonic oscillators are coupled in momentum space. But if we go to co-moving coordinate system, they will decouple, and we have independent harmonic oscillators again, as we will see. Okay, so the advantages are that in the co-moving coordinate, the advantages of using a co-moving coordinate system are that in the co-moving coordinate system, galaxies have constant coordinates, constant distances, because the coordinate system grows with the universe. And also that wavelengths stay constant, even though the physical wavelength that we would measure would, of course, increase. So then how can we write down the metric? But remember that the metric, the line element, is described by the metric in this way, and it gives us the invariant four distance in four-dimensional space. In our coordinates, the metric must take this form. The signature is determined because this is relativity. The signature is 1 minus 1 minus 1 minus 1. We have a factor 1 up here for the time coordinate because it's our wristwatch that we use to measure the time. So we're measuring proper time right there. However, the values that we get in our coordinate system for distances are not physical distances yet. They need to be multiplied with the scale factor, the universe expands, to get the actual physical distance. So in order to get the physical proper distance, we need to multiply spatial distances with this a, and spatial distances squared with a squared. That's why the metric has these a squared factors in here. So what about this scale factor now? Okay, so the scale factor function a of t is needed to take into account the expansion of the universe when calculating distances. At the present time, the scale factor a of t is 1 by convention. This is the time when the co-moving coordinate system coincides with the proper distance coordinate system. And then in the past, a was smaller than 1, and in the future, a will be larger than 1. So the proper distance d between two galaxies with co-moving distances, delta x1, delta x2, delta x3, at some proper time t, is then given by, well, the square root of the invariant distance squared. And the invariant distance squared is given by taking the co-moving distance, multiplying it with the metric, and then we get the proper distance. Because the g has the a squared factor in it, and this has a square root, we can pull out the a squared factor because it occurs in all of these, pull it out of the square root, and we get a of t. So as we should expect, the proper distance between two galaxies is given by the co-moving distance, which for two galaxies that don't have peculiar velocities will always stay the same because the coordinate system grows with the universe. So this is always the same distance between two galaxies, but the proper distance grows proportional to the scale factor. So then what is the dynamics of the scale factor? The scale factor function is determined by all of the equations of the motion. And that means the equations of motion of matter and the equations of motion of space-time, the Einstein equations. How, in principle, do we have to calculate this a of t? Well, first we have to figure out what are the most important fields, matter fields. Is it the electromagnetic field that's dominating, or is it perhaps the field of quarks and electrons, or is it an interton field, a Higgs field, or whatever it might be? Let's look at the dominant fields and calculate their contribution to the energy momentum tensor. Let's call those fields phi. In principle, of course, we need to take all of these fields. But as we will see, for cosmological purposes, in the very early universe, it suffices to look at just one field, the scalar field of the interton field. It dominates the evolution of space-time early on. Okay, so first of all, we need to calculate the energy momentum tensor for given fields, or as a function of the fields. And then we need to solve simultaneously the equations of motion for the fields, which means the Maxwell equation, which by the way has the metric in it, of course, the Dirac equation that has the metric in it, and all the other equations of motion that there might be. For example, Young-Mills equations for the strong force. And then simultaneously, we also have to solve the Einstein equation for the metric. Here it is again. So what we see is that the metric equation of motion, here the Einstein equation, has as an input the energy momentum tensor. And vice versa, the Dirac equation and the Maxwell equation or the other matter equations of motion have as one of their input the metric. So therefore, these are coupled partial differential equations, and even before quantization, it's super difficult in general to solve all of those equations at once. Now, ideally, we would like to quantize all of it and solve all of those equations at the same time. That's super difficult. Therefore, what one usually does, and we will do that here in this course. Also, at some point, we will go a little bit beyond it. What we will do is we will treat gravity mostly classically. And we will treat the matter fields as quantum fields. So we will take into account the quantum fluctuations of the matter fields. And in a first attempt, we will not take into account the quantum fluctuations of gravity. But eventually, we will have to take them into account too. And perturbatively, we can do it. The first order perturbations, we can do that, and we will do it. Okay, so we will quantize, to begin with, just the matter fields, but not the metric. But then the energy momentum tensor of the matter fields, if the matter fields are quantized, the energy momentum tensor will have a hat too, because it depends on the fields that have hats on them, quantum fields. So therefore, in the Einstein equation, where T mu nu is supposed to be number valued, we need to cook this down from an operator valued energy momentum tensor to a number valued energy momentum tensor. And that we can do by doing what is called the semi-classical approximation. So given the state of the quantum field, we can calculate what the expectation value is of the energy momentum tensor, and then we feed the energy expectation, the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor into the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Now, this is fundamentally limited. You can think of it this way. In the Einstein equation, we have on the left-hand side the curvature tensor, which describes the curvature at one point in space and time. And on the right-hand side, we have the energy momentum tensor that describes energy momentum at one point in space and time, which is paradoxical, because we can't know energy momentum at a point. The uncertainty principle prevents us from knowing this. Right, so we can't have energy and momentum localized. It's a fundamental thing. There are limitations to how seriously we can take this. Fortunately, in cosmology, we usually don't except if we go to the very beginning of the universe, we usually don't run into that regime where that matters. Okay, so what we will do is this. Well, ideally, we would quantize gravity and the matter fields and solve all of those equations all at once, which nobody knows how to do, especially because gravity doesn't really lend itself to quantization easily because it is so highly nonlinear. So what we will do is we will work in a semi-classical approximation where we use this energy momentum tensor that is just an expectation value. But further, we make another approximation, at least at the beginning. We will free ourselves from that constraint soon, but at the beginning, we will simply prescribe the evolution of the scale factor. So we will simply say, let's assume that for whatever reason, the universe expands in a particular way. So there's a particular function A of t given. Then, how do the fields react to this? How do quantum fields that live on such a space-time behave? How do their quantum fluctuations behave? That will already be very instructive. And then in a further step, we will ask, given that this expanding space-time impacts the behavior of the quantum fields, the quantum fields must have some effect on, I mean, gravity will affect the quantum fields, which will then affect the T mu nu, which would then affect gravity again. So we have to solve this consistently eventually. But at the beginning, let's just say we have some time evolution of the space-time given by an FRW metric with a given scale factor, and we just ask, let's assume we have fields that go along for the ride. They just live on that space-time. They don't impact it much. The space-time does what it does. A of t is the scale factor. And we just ask, how does that impact the field? We will later ask how the field impacts the space-time, and especially how the quantum fluctuations of the field will impact the space-time. Okay, so for now, we will assume that the scale factor is given, and then we come back to these discussions. All right, so we defined the cosmic time, which was basically our wristwatch time. And we defined a co-moving coordinate system, which is just an ordinary coordinate system now. But we think of it as expanding with the space-time in the future and shrinking with the space-time towards the past. So in this way, the metric can be written in this particular form, which looks convenient. But it could be better. It could be more convenient. Wouldn't it be convenient if this also had an a squared in here? Because if instead of a 1, we had an a squared, we could pull the a squared out of it. And we would just have the Minkowski metric here, 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, except for a prefactor. And that we can achieve. We can achieve it by measuring time differently. By instead of using a wristwatch, that clicks at a sort of constant rate, we use a watch that clicks at a sort of weird rate that is given by, that is influenced by the expansion of the universe. If we let our clocks tick appropriately, and it's just a matter of a non-trivial choice of coordinate system along the time axis, right? In GR, we can always choose our time axis, just like our spatial coordinates, whichever way we want, but we can redefine the time axis, have a funny wristwatch such that this will have a factor of a squared in there. And that new time coordinate is called the conformal time coordinate. How can we do this? Well, we can achieve this by making sure that the following holds. If we have a small conformal time difference, like a small amount of conformal time passed, then square that with multiply with the square of a, this should be the proper time squared, right? If we can find a time variable such that this is true, then wherever there was a delta t squared, we will replace it with an a squared delta eta squared, which means that the metric will pick up a factor of a squared there. But we need this for infinitesimal changes of eta and infinitesimal changes of t. So what we need is that a d eta, I just took the square root of this now, a d eta is equal to dt. Now that means that we need that d eta by dt, so the rate of clicking of our new modernized watch with respect to the rate of clicking of the old-fashioned watch has to be 1 over a. So again, today, where a is equal to 1, same. But in the future, the clock will click more slowly, right? And in the past, it clicked faster. Because you see, d eta by dt, how many clicks of eta per click of proper time, right? And in the future, a is large, so this is small, so it clicks more slowly. So the conformal time is a weird time coordinate in that, but coordinate systems are immaterial in GR. Now that's a differential equation that we can solve. And we find as the solution that the conformal time as a function of the proper time has to be the integral over 1 over a, 1 over a, up to the present time. And where we start that integral doesn't matter. This is just providing an arbitrary integration constant. And this is to say that where we start numerically, our conformal time doesn't really matter. We can always add a million years to it or whatever. That's just the starting point of our time axis. What matters is not where the starting point is, but what the rate is. So this new time variable eta is called the conformal time. And why is it called the conformal time? Well, it's because using the conformal time variable and using the co-moving coordinate system, so using a coordinate system that grows with the space-time, and a clock whose ticking rate adjusts also with the space-time. It's, you can think of it this way. It's like you have a clock that consists of two mirrors, and you have a ray of light bouncing between the two, and then that's your clock ticking. Now, as the universe expands and the two mirrors drift away from each other, right, then this clock ticks more slowly. And that's the kind of clock that we have here in conformal time. So now in this new choice of coordinate system with the expanding coordinate system and also the expanding clocks, we have that the metric takes this form, where we can pull this prefactor, the scale factor, out of the metric. So this shows us that at any point in time, FRW spacetime is not distinguishable from Minkowski space, the same thing. It's just changing by a scale factor that depends on the time. By the way, notice that we use eta now for two different things. Eta mu nu is the metric in Minkowski space, Cartesian coordinates, and eta is the conformal time variable. So please don't mix them up, but you should not mix them up. I mean, it should be easy to distinguish them because one of them has two indices and the other one doesn't. Okay, so this also means that the inverse of the metric with two contravariant indices, two upper indices instead of two lower indices, which is, if you remember, just the inverse matrix, that also is proportional to the eta of Minkowski space, but now with the inverse prefactor. Okay, so remember that the metric with the lower indices and the metric with the upper indices are as matrices, directly inverses of another. So now that we have the metric, we can easily calculate all the ingredients in the Laplacian, in the action, and all of this formalism that we had before. In particular, if you remember, the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric came up a lot. And what do we have here? Well, we have the metric, which has now a squared everywhere on the diagonal, which means that the determinant has a to the power 8 in it, because it's the product of all the terms in the diagonal, each one contributes a squared. So we have a to the power 8 with a minus from the time, because it's indefinite signature. And then we have to take the absolute value of that, it's a to the power 8, and then we take the square root of it, that's a to the power 4. So the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric, which is occurring quite often, is a to the power 4. Now, let's see what that does in the general framework. So if you look at the Klein-Gordon equation, for now without a potential, then in general, it takes this form. Here's the kinetic term that has the derivatives, and here's the mass term. Then we can now write down what this action is in the case of FRW spacetimes. This factor we just established is a to the power 4. And here we have the derivatives, we just carry them forward. The metric is just the Minkowski metric, and we have a prefactor of a to the power minus 2 because this metric carries upper indices, it's the inverse metric. So we have already the Klein-Gordon action right there. And now let's look at the Klein-Gordon equation. The Klein-Gordon equation in general looks like this. And in our special case for FRW spacetimes, we now know that it takes this. This is from the square root of g. And then this is just from the metric. So here we have the Klein-Gordon equation. There is something non-trivial, though, that I need to make you aware of. Super important. When we take the general Klein-Gordon equation for the general case of any space-time, we notice here this factor becomes 1 over a to the 4th, right? Then here we have derivatives. Here we have the metric. Here we have something with a to the power 4. In here, we have that it's a diagonal matrix with a squared terms in there, right? Actually, it's a to the power minus 2 because we have upper indices, it's the inverse metric. So that means we get actually that together they are a squared terms. And it would seem that that's it. Not quite, because something new is happening here, which is super important, which is ultimately the reason why we have to introduce the co-moving coordinate system. The thing about decoupling degrees of freedom, let me show you. These are space derivatives, but also time derivative. And this time derivative will act not only on the field, it will, but not only on the field, it also gets hung up on the time dependence of A. Right? And so that changes the character of the Klein-Gordon equation now. So let's see how it does that. Here we have it all the way before we actually do what we just said we have to do. We have to do this time derivative. Right? So as far as the space derivatives are concerned, no problem, but you have to be careful with the time derivatives. So what do we get? We get 1 over a to the 4th, and then we have all of this acting on the phi squared, as usual. This is the case where the time derivative acts on phi. But by the product rule, we also get a term where the time derivative d by dx mod is acting on a squared. And that gives us a term, 1 over a to the 4th. And then the time derivative acting on the a squared gives us a 2a times, by the chain rule, a prime. And then d by dx naught acting on that. Oh, I should say that when we differentiate with respect to the conformal time, we use a prime. When we differentiate with respect to the proper time, let's use a dot. So here we see the prime. It means we do a derivative with respect to conformal time, right? Because we are working here in conformal time. That's where you're working with the eta. That's where we have the simplification that the metric is simply Minkowski metric with an a squared factor in front. All right, so if we now spell this out, what do we get? We get that the second time derivative, conformal time derivative of the field. Okay, let's see. Overall, we have here an a squared divided by a to the fourth. That gives us 1 over a squared. Here, we have a over a to the fourth, well, times a prime, but that gives us 1 over a to the third power. Okay. So let us multiply that entire equation with an a squared term. Because if we do, then at least all the a's in the leading term here, the kinetic term, will go away. You don't have to do it this way, but it's convenient to write it this way. So let us collect the terms in here and multiply all of them with a squared. If we do that, then this multiplied with the a squared factor cancels that, and we just get, as the leading term here, eta naught naught, so that's just the two time derivatives acting on phi, that's this term here. And then we get also the term with the ii here. Again, no factors of a, because we multiply everything with a squared, so we get an a to the fourth, canceling that. And then we get the Laplacian here. We get the space derivatives, the second space derivatives. That's this term here, no a squared prefactor. So this much would be the ordinary D'Alembert operator of Minkowski space. But we also get this term here. Remember, we multiply with a squared, so we get an a to the third divided by a to the fourth, so we get overall an a, 1 over a, and in the numerator we have an a prime, so we have a prime over a. This term becomes that term. And then we just carry forward the m squared term. Remember, we multiplied the entire equation with a squared, so we get a squared m squared. All right, so new things are happening here. What's new is this term, it's entirely new, and that the mass term acquired this extra a squared. So this is the Klein-Gordon equation in FRW space-time. And right away we notice that we'll have to do something about this, because don't really have much experience with dealing with this type of term, because it has only one time derivative in it. If you remember from mechanics, what does it mean if you have a term with one time derivative? It's typically friction, right? And you don't want harmonic oscillators with friction terms. See, second derivative and then something else that's just phi, that's harmonic oscillators. But this looks like it's a friction term. Let's try to get rid of this so that we can let's try to reformulate the problem such that this is absorbed in some way, so that we get just harmonic oscillators, because there we know how to deal with them. So the problem is that our Klein-Gordon equation has this general form, phi double prime plus something phi prime plus something phi, and that's the offending term here. It turns out that it's not hard to change variables so that this term goes away. And the strategy is to use a new field variable. Instead of using the field phi itself, we use a new field variable, let's call it chi, and it is defined to be scale factor times the actual field. So the first field is phi, but we define a new field, a new auxiliary field, chi, which is a times phi. So in particular, whatever phi does at late times, chi will be large in amplitude, right? Because it gets multiplied with the scale factor. If the universe is expanding a lot, then the chi will apparently have much larger amplitudes there. So now that we switch to the new variable chi, let's just keep in mind that whatever we calculate, if we want to go back to the physics of phi, We have to divide by A to get the field phi. All right. This is a little bit unusual because normally we change coordinate system, which is where these fields live. But now we define another field. It's like instead of changing coordinates in the domain, we are changing coordinates in the image. But as long as we keep track of everything, it should be fine. Just have to be very careful as we do this, as you will see in a moment. Okay, so we define the new field chi. Then what do we get? We have that the time derivative, and when I say time derivative, at the moment we always mean the conformal time derivative. So phi prime is the d by the eta of phi, but phi is chi over A, right? Phi is chi over A. So what is that then? Well, then we obtain that phi prime is, by the product rule, minus A prime over A squared times chi plus 1 over A K prime by the product rule. And what about the space derivatives? Well, if we differentiate the field with respect to a spatial variable, then this is the derivative with the spatial variable of 1 over A times chi, but A doesn't have a space dependence. So the spatial derivative doesn't get hung up on that, and we just get 1 over A chi, comma I. Now, if we substitute these findings into the action, then we can replace all occurrences of phi prime, and of the space derivatives of phi by expressions in terms of chi. And if we do that, this is what we find. And remember that the action in terms of phi had already a time-dependent mass term. Now it takes this particular form here. And let me point out something important in this already, which is that when you look at this term, the mass term, you see that, well, the mass is positive. In any case, it's squared, right? So this is a positive constant. As the universe is expanding, this gets larger. But consider also that A double prime over A is changing over time in general. And you could imagine that this term might, under certain circumstances, dominate over that one. Right? But that's interesting, because if that happens, then it is as if we had a harmonic oscillator with an inverted potential, right? Because we have here the time derivatives, and then we have all the other stuff here times chi, as usual in a harmonic oscillator. But I should say this term might dominate over that and that, in fact, right? So that overall, you see, this comes with a negative sign, this comes with a negative sign, but that one comes with a positive sign. That term might dominate. It might flip the sign of the back driving force. Let's keep an eye on this particular term that appears here, the A double prime over A. Okay, I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that when you rewrite the action in terms of the chi field, it takes this form. Now, what's the equation of motion? Well, let's see. Is this trivial or non-trivial? In principle, we should calculate the equation of motion by setting, classically, ds by d phi equal to zero. That's the extremal action principle. But we could also set ds by d chi equal to zero. Which is it? Which should we do? It turns out it doesn't matter. And that's because if ds by d phi is equal to zero, then let's see, by the chain rule, ds by d phi is ds by d chi by d phi. But d chi by d phi is just a scale factor, it's not zero. So therefore, if one of them is zero, the other one is also zero. It doesn't matter what we extremize. And this means that we can calculate the equation of motion for the chi field in two ways. We can take the equation of motion for phi that we just calculated, the one which had this offending friction term in it, and just substitute in the chi field now. Or we can take the action of the chi field and then evaluate the Euler-Lagrange equation. It gives you the same thing. So in particular, this is what it is. And nicely, there is no longer a first-time derivative in chi. It's just second-time derivative in chi, and this stuff doesn't have a time derivative. Which is nice, right? Because it's basically harmonic oscillators. What's preventing this from being just harmonic oscillators is that we have here Laplace term. But if we do a Fourier transform with respect to the co-moving distances, remember our coordinate system is a co-moving coordinate system. So if we now do a Fourier transform with respect to the co-moving coordinate system, coordinates, then this Laplacian becomes a k-squared. And then we are in business again, because we have second time derivative in momentum space equal to k-squared and some other stuff times chi. Therefore, we have a harmonic oscillator with a regular back-driving force and no friction term in it. So this is where all the magic sits, right? What we see here is that at every point in momentum space, in co-moving momentum space, remember this would not have worked out if we had worked in proper coordinate system that doesn't grow with the flow, then we would not have simply had that, we would have other terms, so we would have first space derivatives in there and stuff like that. And even just, yeah, it would have been much more messy. But since we worked with the co-moving coordinate system, we can do this. We can still decouple these harmonic oscillators. In position space, they are coupled harmonic oscillators. Because remember, if we discretize position space, this Laplace operator becomes a finite difference operator. And so we get that. Without this, this is a harmonic oscillator at every point in position space. With that, these harmonic oscillators are coupled. And then if we transform, we obtain uncoupled harmonic oscillators in momentum space, in co-moving momentum space. And depending on how big this is, it may or may not flip the sign of the back-driving force. So now let's prepare for quantization. What do we need for that? Well, we need to know what the canonically conjugate field is for chi. Right? Because we want to work with the chi field, then what is its canonically conjugate? That we can impose the canonical commutation relations. Well, we can calculate what its canonically conjugate is by using the Legendre transform. Because remember, that's how it arises. So to this end, we consider the Lagrangian. Remember, if we integrate this over time as well, covariantly, then we get the action. If we drop the time derivative, then we just get the Lagrangian. It's the Legendre transform with respect to chi prime gives us the Hamiltonian. And in the process of doing the Legendre transform, we find out what the canonically conjugate variable to chi prime is. Remember, that's why we did the whole detour with the covariant formalism, so that we can figure out what the canonically conjugate variables are. But now we're working with chi. For phi, we already have it, but let's work it out for chi. Here's the Lagrangian, and if we do the Legendre transform now, so we have to take this variable chi prime and then calculate dl by d chi prime, then that's the new variable, that's the variable, the canonically conjugate to the chi prime, that's the pi. This is what the Hamiltonian will contain. It will contain phi, chi and pi. And what is it? Well, dl by d chi prime on FOW spacetimes is simply chi prime. Because look, we differentiate with respect to this. There's no prefactor of any funny kind in front of it. It's very simple. Canonically conjugate to pi is simply chi prime. Now, for completeness, let us nevertheless figure out what is the field canonically conjugate to phi. Here's the Klein-Gordon action again, now expressed in phi again. We can calculate easily what the canonically conjugate field is to phi by taking the Lagrangian, so we just drop the time integration, and then functionally differentiating with respect to phi prime. But if you functionally differentiate with respect to phi prime, then, well, you see the phi prime is the phi comma zero here, and here phi comma zero. If we do the functional differentiation there, we pick up a squared phi prime. Why a squared? Well, there's a 1 over a squared, and there's an e to the 4th. In total, that's a 1 over a squared. So the canonically conjugate field to phi, we call it pi superscript phi, is a squared phi prime. Let's see, is this in disguise the same as the canonically conjugate fields to chi, if we just express them in terms of each other? No, it's not. It's a different canonically conjugate field. It's calculated. What the canonically conjugate field to chi was chi prime. But chi is a times phi. So chi prime is a phi prime. And that gives us two terms. We get a phi prime plus a prime phi. And we can carry this one just forward to the next line. But the chi prime is, but a times phi prime is 1 over a pi of a superscript phi, right? Because of this here. Right, so we have that phi prime is equal to pi phi divided by a squared. So phi prime is pi phi divided by a squared, so we get a 1 over a. So this means that the canonically conjugate field to chi is not the same as the canonically conjugate field to phi. They differ. They differ by prefactor, but also by the addition of an extra term. Well, now if we quantize, the proper way to quantize is, of course, to quantize the actual physical degrees of freedom. So the commutator between the phi and the pi should be this. And then we need to calculate what that means for the commutator between the unphysical fields chi and pi, superscript pi. And here's the proposition, not hard to prove, which is that if we substitute here phi and pi expressed in terms of chi and its canonically conjugate, then we obtain that chi and its canonically conjugate obey the same commutation relation. It just so happens that they just come out the same. And ultimately, that's because one goes with a factor of a, the other one goes with a factor of 1 over a. See, we only have to prove the first one. This is the only non-trivial one here. The others are trivial. Let's see how that works out. So we have the commutator between chi and pi. Pi superscript chi. Well, chi is a times phi by definition. And we calculated what pi superscript chi is in terms of these fields. And we got those two terms. But the extra term here is proportional to phi, and that commutes with the phi, so that drops out. And here we simply have a 1 over a, and here we have an a, so they cancel each out. We just get the commutator, we get the Dirac delta. So that's very nice, because what we have now is that in terms of this auxiliary field chi and its canonically conjugate, we have simpler equations of motion, because we have a harmonic oscillator equation of motion, we have a Klein-Gordon equation of motion. that has no friction term, that has a funny mass term, funny back-driving force term that may or may not flip sign. We have to check the circumstances when this happens. And the canonical commutation relations are the same, so we can quantize as usual. So the change from phi to the chi variable is fairly trivial. Notice, however, that there is something funny going on here with the Legendre transform that we have to be very clear about. The action is unique. And when we drop the time variable, we get to Lagrangian. Now that Lagrangian, we can, and we did, we can express it in terms of phi or in terms of chi. If we express it in terms of phi, the Legendre transform gives us a Hamiltonian which depends on phi and its canonically conjugate pi superscript phi. If, on the other hand, we take the Lagrangian, express it in terms of chi and its canonically conjugate, then we obtain its canonically conjugate, chi superscript pi, and we obtain a Hamiltonian which is expressed in terms of chi and its canonically conjugate momentum. So the Legendre transform gives us two different Hamiltonians depending on which variables we choose. Now both are correct. We can calculate the time evolution with either of them. But isn't it weird that we have two different Hamiltonians for the same system? Isn't the Hamiltonian supposed to be the energy? How can we have two different Hamiltonians for the same thing? And that's not even something that only happens in GR. You could also, in ordinary first quantized quantum mechanics, you could just choose, instead of your position operator, you could choose a of t being some function times the position operator, to become your new position operator y, right? So a of t times x is y, same story. So it's fundamental. In quantum theory, we can do this. Now, normally we would have no reason, and we would always say, well, there's a canonical choice of variable, why would we ever use the other ones? Here, though, we really want to use this other variable, so let's clarify what's going on. And in particular, let's clarify what is really the energy here. Given that these two Hamiltonians are generally not the same. So how can both be generators of the time evolution? How can we have that this Heisenberg equation is true and that Heisenberg equation is true? Right? We have that the time derivative of phi is generated by h superscript phi, by the Hamiltonian obtained by the Legendre transform with respect to phi, and chi prime, time evolution of chi, is given by the same thing, but now with the other Hamiltonian. Both equations are true. And the Hamiltonians are different. Shouldn't there be one Hamiltonian for all variables? But the answer is yes, there is a Hamiltonian for all variables. You can choose this one. It's h superscript phi. That's the Hamiltonian for all variables. Remember that the equations of motion in classical mechanics, as also in quantum mechanics, are not simply this in general, or simply that in general. The equations of motion are always of that form that if q is some observable of your system, then the time derivative of it is generated by the commutator of q with the Hamiltonian plus the time derivative of that variable, that observable, with respect to any implicitly built-in time dependence. Right? If you use as your observable the angular momentum or a position or momentum operator, then you never need to worry about these things. You always have that the time evolution of your observable is generated by the Hamiltonian. But if you cook up a non-trivial observable with an explicitly by hand put in time dependence, then of course this Hamiltonian doesn't know about. And that extra time dependence that you built in by hand is taken into account by that term. So for example, in quantum mechanics, you could choose as your observable x1 plus 2p2. Fine. This will be true, right? Without that extra term. But what if you choose as your observable x1 plus cosine omega t times p2? Now you have an observable that is self-adjoint, but it has some time dependence built in that you made up, the cosine in there. So basically, at every point in time, you're looking at a different observable. Still, the Hamiltonian generates the time evolution, but this time derivative now plays a role that will pick up on that time dependence in the cosine of t. And that's the situation we have here, because while phi is the physical field, chi is an observable that at every point in time is expressed differently in terms of phi. Phi has an explicit time dependence in addition to the evolution of the physics. We have put an a of t in the definition of chi. Right? Remember that chi was a of t times phi. So we've put something like cosine in there, sine in there. If a of t, we put that in there. So we should expect that there's an extra term here. So if we want to use the Hamiltonian of phi to calculate the evolution of chi, then we have to take into account that there's an extra time dependence built into it. From the perspective of this Hamiltonian, no. Chi doesn't have an extra time dependence, but from the perspective of that Hamiltonian, it does. So explicitly, what we have is this. Chi is by definition a times phi. We also have that phi prime is, its evolution is generated by h superscript phi. And then we have that phi prime is, phi is chi divided by a, so phi prime is chi divided by a prime. What is that then? Well, we obtain that this is then the commutator of chi with h phi. Right. See, what we did is phi is chi over h. So here we replace phi with chi over a. Right. So phi is chi over a. So here we replaced phi by chi over a, and here we replaced chi phi over a. So we just substituted this into here. We obtained that. Now let's work out what we get over here. We get two terms. One term where the prime acts on the chi, and another term where the prime acts on the 1 over a, giving us this. So we get, that is just carried forward here. So now, let's solve that equation for I times I prime. So we multiply the entire equation by A and put this stuff on the right-hand side, and we get this. So what we obtain is that I chi prime is, that the evolution of chi prime is generated by H phi, but we have this extra term here because chi is not a fundamental variable. It is defined in terms of the fundamental variable phi in a time-dependent way. And that's what's being picked up here. Okay, so I hope that clarified that you can work with either Hamiltonian you want, but with respect to one Hamiltonian, one set of variables is fundamental. And with respect to the other one, the other set is fundamental. It's either phi and pi phi, or it's chi and chi phi. Can work with either. All right. So, and by the way, just to make sure, we also write down the time evolution of chi prime as generated by h superscript chi. Well, there's no extra term because from the perspective of this Hamiltonian choice, from the perspective of these variables, chi is fundamental, so there's an extra term. If you compare the two equations, we see that the two Hamiltonians are indeed different. Okay. So, since there are multiple Hamiltonians, which one is the energy? For GR, this is an important question. Now, usually we define the energy, that is to say the Hamiltonian, as the generator of time evolution. Right? As we just saw, it's, you know, an observable time differentiated is equal to 1 over I times the commutator of that observable with the Hamiltonian. So in that sense, the Hamiltonian generates time evolution. Now, we have two Hamiltonians.
And they generate time evolution differently.
So what we do in GR is not to define the energy as the generator of time evolution. Instead, in GR, we define energy as arising from the energy momentum tensor. And the energy momentum tensor arises from differentiating the action with respect to the metric. So basically, the energy is interpreted as what generates curvature. Energy is what is on the right-hand side of the action equation. Energy is what curves space. So we define energy through its impact in space-time. So here we have the Einstein equation, and we have on the right-hand side the energy-momentum tensor. And the zero-zero component is the energy density. Of course, the momentum also curves space, but our interest now is in energy. So energy and momentum are curving space here in this way. And now we can ask, how is the zero-zero component of energy-momentum tensor related to our two funny Hamiltonians? Each one of these Hamiltonians wants to be the energy. But this is unambiguous. T naught naught is generating curvature. It is what curves space here. It's the leading term if you want to calculate how the sun is curving the space around it. It's the T naught naught term that makes the Earth go around the sun to lowest order. Now let's look at what the energy momentum tensor is for a Klein-Gordon field. For a Klein-Gordon field, the energy momentum tensor takes this form. As usual, as always, the energy momentum tensor is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric, with this prefactor. And if you work it out explicitly for the Klein-Gordon field, as we had it some lectures ago, it is explicitly this expression. Now, let us look at T naught naught, the energy density. T naught naught takes this form. Now, I leave it to you as an exercise to verify, first of all, that this is right, that this is T naught naught. But then, also, write down what the Hamiltonian in terms of phi is, the Hamiltonian superscript phi is, that you obtain by taking the Lagrangian, then doing the Legendre transform with respect to phi prime, so that you can you then get the Hamiltonian in terms of phi and pi superscript phi. And then what you can show is that the Hamiltonian superscript phi, where everything was calculated using the first set of fields, that Hamiltonian is actually the integral over space of T naught naught. Right? So we see that this one is preferred. Gravity prefers this one. Because remember, this is not the same Hamiltonian as that one. But this one is the integral over the energy density. And it makes sense to say that the total energy is the integral over the energy density. Okay, so the H phi is not just obtained immediately from the field, physical field, but it's also singled out because it is what you get when you integrate over the energy density. Right. Are there any questions?
Yes. So these two Hamiltonians, they have same energy spectrum?
So far, this was all classical. We did not quantize them. And in when you quantize them, then the energy spectrum is going to be continuous. Well, it depends. If there's a mass, then there could be a gap. But if there's no gap, then the energy spectrum is continuous. See, because Well, it's, let's say for photons, the energy spectrum starts somewhere. We might define it to be zero. In gravity, that's not so trivial. You can't just subtract energies without expense, because gravity is in principle susceptible to every form of energy. But you set somewhere the baseline of the energy for the electromagnetic field, and then every photon contributes its h bar omega. But omega can be as small as you want, which means that there's no gap. If you have a part, so the spectrum of the Hamiltonian of field theory, such as the electromagnetic one, is continuous. It's the positive half axis. But if you have a massive theory, then you need, for example, for electrons, positrons, then you have a gap, and you need at least on the order of an MeV to produce an electron positron pair, for example, even if they're at the lowest momentum.
Can you go over the commutator proof again?
Right. Oh, it sounded out. Do you mean that the commutator in terms of the chi is the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
That one.
Yes. Okay, so chi is A times pi. And chi, a pi superscript chi is given by these two terms. Now, the second term commutes with this because both depend only on chi. And then this term has this A, 1 over A and that A canceling each other, because they're just multiplied with the identity operator, right? So as far as the commutator is concerned, you don't care. So they cancel each other, and then you're just left with the commutator between phi and pi, which is the usual. Okay. Okay. Good. Any more questions?
How do we know that pi is square omega?
How do we know that pi superscript chi is given by these two terms?
Yeah, we found that.
Yes. This happened.
Oh, yeah.
You found it?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. We had it. What are we looking for? Pi superscript chi, right? In terms of phi variables?
Mm-hmm.
Right, and it was this, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Good.